I'm sorry for the or is it something that we're going to live with for now many, many decades? There's six factors. We can argue about the relative importance of those six factors, but they are increased demand from rapidly developing countries, especially China, especially as they've become economically stronger, more demand for meat. Poor harvest due to variable weather around the world, very poor harvest in the US, in Australia and other parts, potentially, but I cannot attribute those poor harvests directly to human-induced climate change, but they would be the sorts of factors that would have happened in the future. Increased use of biofuels, especially when we use a food crop for fuel, especially maize in the USA. High energy prices, therefore high price of mechanisation, high price of fertiliser. Export bans to some developing countries because they wanted to protect their domestic market and speculation on the commodity market. All occurring when we had very low food stocks around the world. So clearly we have a blip. In very poor countries, this is potentially a crisis, which could put another 100 million people into poverty. In a relatively affluent society like Europe, it's clearly a concern, especially when food prices are increasing at a time when there's energy price increases, etc. So clearly this issue is a concern. However, I should note that food prices, even today, have come down a little from a few months ago, they're still much, much cheaper than the 1970s and the 1980s. So it is an increase recently, but it is not to the level that it was in the 70s and 80s. Are these going to be issues for just today or the future? Clearly, these are issues that we will face in the future. There will be continued demand in countries such as China and changing both the type of food and the amount of food they need. We will see an increase in variable harvest, in almost certainly, because of human-induced climate change over the next numbers of decades. There is potentially going to be an increased demand for biofuels throughout the world. The question is whether we continue to use food stocks for fuel, or we can actually go to second and third generation biofuels, which I think we need to do, and still check that they are both environmentally, socially, and economically sustainable. Energy price, well, it's variable and volatile at the moment. It's almost come down by a factor of two in the last couple of months, but it could easily go up by a factor of two. So we're likely to see higher energy prices than we clearly experienced in the 1990s and the beginning of this century. Now, hopefully we won't see export bans from large exporting countries. It's not in their best interest overall, but it is a short-term measure that many take, and who knows what will happen on the commodity market. Agriculture at one level has had an incredible success over the last 50 years. Food production has exceeded the rate of population increase. Therefore, today we have more food per capita than we've ever had. And until the last couple of years, as you can see on the dotted line, food prices are at an all-time low. And you can see it's significantly cheaper than 1973 when we had the oil crisis. Not so much one of the problems, but one of the problems is we still have 850 million people go to bed hungry every day. So in spite of the successes, we clearly have not achieved our goal of hunger alleviation. But it's not just that, we've seen uneven effects of the increased yield. That is to say, not everybody has gained from these increased yields, and I've got a slide in a second. And in addition, we've seen environmental costs. We've seen the addition of greenhouse gases from the agricultural sector into the atmosphere. We've seen a degradation in many parts of the world of soils and water and a loss of biodiversity. And then we've seen that loss both in the way we've intensified agriculture and the way we've extensified. So there's a real challenge. It doesn't matter whether we extensify or intensify, there is an environmental challenge in whatever way we go. This simply shows it's hard to see that, as I say, major increase in production in most parts of Asia, not all parts, but especially in China. We've almost doubled it in the last few decades. But in sub-Saharan Africa, it's actually gone down. So many, many people are less hungry in China than they were a few years ago. But in sub-Saharan Africa, if anything, the situation has got worse. So increased global yield has not benefited everybody. It has certainly benefited a lot of people. This is simply a map of India. And in the very dark colour, this is where you have child malnutrition for children under 5. 50% of children in this area of India are malnourished. In a lighter brown, it's still about up to 40%. So even in India, where the Green Revolution was a major part of decreasing hunger and famine, we still have a major challenge to overcome in making sure children under 5 are not malnourished. We've also seen that during the classical Green Revolution, a significant increase in yield, literally throughout Asia, this particular show, but in the last decade and a half, it's flattened. In other words, the classical Green Revolution appears to run out of steam. There's no question we need more food. The question is, how do we get there? As I said, it's not only an issue of uneven distribution or benefits socially. From an environmental standpoint, the way we've intensified, we've used more nitrogen fertilizers, more nitrous oxide to the atmosphere, is affecting the Earth's climate. Of course, it's a minor contributor compared to CO2, but it is a contributor. In addition, of course, we're also seeing methane from rice production and cattle, so there are several contributions of agriculture to climate change. And of course, climate change itself, we project, will undermine agricultural productivity, certainly throughout the developing world, and eventually start to potentially undermine it even in Europe as it becomes hotter, and especially as southern Europe becomes drier. In addition, what we've seen, especially with inappropriate irrigation in some parts of the world, land degradation, loss of that, loss of fertility, salinization, erosion, hence as we degrade our land, again, undermines food production. We've also extensified, we've increased the use of the amount of land we've used for agriculture. It's cut down a lot of moist tropical forests. As we've cut down a short moist tropical forest, we've put carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, contributing to climate change. But in addition, it's had a major impact on loss of biodiversity at the genetic, species and ecosystem level. And loss of genetic biodiversity, again, can potentially undermine agricultural productivity. So we have to face agriculture in the middle of both the social system and the environmental system. From a greenhouse gas perspective, it simply says what I've already said. We're seeing a loss of CO2 into the atmosphere due to deforestation, methane and nitrous oxide, and fertilizers, cattle and rice production. And today, if you look at agriculture, which includes, in my opinion, deforestation, it's 30% of all of the emissions are into the atmosphere. So even if I was a technological optimist, which I am, and that we could truly go to something close to zero carbon energy production and energy use, I do believe we can get there with the right policies, the right financing. We can get there both domestically and internationally. It will take time, but we can get there. I think one of the biggest challenges is reducing the 30% of greenhouse gas emissions that are coming from the agricultural sector. So I can be a real optimist on technology, and actually a little less of an optimist in the agricultural sector. Major perturbation to the nitrogen cycle. We've perturbed the nitrogen cycle more than the carbon cycle. It's led, of course, to major adverse effects on some aquatic ecosystems, polluted rivers. We now have several hundred dead zones around the world in coastal areas. The worst is probably in the Gulf of Mexico, just off of New Orleans, a major dead zone due to effectively the input of nitrates into the water column. We're also looking at a major loss of biodiversity at the moment throughout the world, both at the species level and affecting major ecosystems. The five major threats to biodiversity are habitat change, and that's largely due, not exclusively, to agriculture extensifying. We've got climate change, which is not a big driver of biodiversity loss at the moment, but likely to become one over the coming few decades of the century. We've got invasive species, both purposeful and accidental, and some of that is clearly due to agriculture. We've got overexploitation of ecosystems. The best example of that would actually be in the oceans of the world, where 25% of the world's oceans are currently overfished, 50% at the maximum tolerance of fishing, and only 25% with any additional potential of increased catch. And with fishing down the trophic chain, so the size of the fish we're catching today is much smaller than the size of the fish we were catching a decade or so. And we've got pollution from nitrogen and phosphorus, again of which agriculture is linked. So agriculture is again not only linked obviously into climate change, it's linked into biodiversity loss. And it simply shows the loss of land, not all due of course to agriculture, some due to roads and cities, But this one in this first orangey colour is how much land had we lost up to 1950. This comes from the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment that I also chaired a couple of years earlier. Then the sort of the light red is what did we lose from 1950 to 1990, and the dark red is what do we project over the next 50 years. And as you can see in the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, and we took these results into the agricultural assessment, no point redoing. Major continued loss of many major ecosystems, especially in the tropics, as we try and get food for hunger and poverty alleviation. So what are the future challenges? Well, we need to double food production. We need to make it more cost effective. We need to make it more nutritious over the next 25 to 50 years. Why do we need a sustainable agricultural sector? We need to feed the world. But we also need to enhance rural livelihoods. If you look at Africa, probably half the countries in Africa have an agricultural GDP that's between 25 and 60% of total national GDP. So rural livelihoods, economic growth, especially for many countries in Africa, absolutely central to the drive out of poverty. But we also have to meet food safety standards, and we have to do all of this in an environmentally and socially sustainable manner. And that's the challenge. How do we increase production? How do we increase productivity? But do it in a way that meets food safety standards, it meets environmental and social standards. And we have to do it at a time of unparalleled challenges. Less labour. In many developing countries, we have HIV/AIDS. We also have endemic diseases such as malaria, dengue and cholera. We've also seen a major migration away from the rural area to cities because people believe they have more chance of becoming relatively better off, and that's a relative statement, in the city than they do in the rural area. So less labour for effectively agriculture. Less water. One is more demand from our other sectors such as industry and households. But we're also seeing competition for water, changing the competition because there's actually less water going to be because of climate change in the future in both arid and semi-arid areas. Less arable land, more competition. Biofuels, for example, are put in competition now with food. We're obviously seeing more degraded land, therefore less suitable to growing crops. Still got land policy conflicts with individual property rights and collective property rights. I've already talked about increasing loss of biodiversity, a changing climate, and increasing levels of pollution, tropospheric ozone, acid deposition, a major threat in many developing countries. And therefore agriculture no longer can be considered to be production alone. We've got to have sustainable agriculture, or in other words, the multifunctionality of agriculture. We have to place agriculture into a social context. We have to recognise the important role of gender, tradition, culture, and of course linked to human health. The environmental issues I've largely talked about, soils, water, climate and biodiversity. And economically we have to recognise we have to place agriculture in the marketing system and of course the trade issue. And there one of the major issues are, do the current trade system stimulate agricultural productivity and agricultural production in developing countries or inhibit it? The argument would be it largely inhibits it because when you have excess food, which we often have, it's dumped into developing countries and it actually, basically, it does not allow the incentives to grow food locally. There's been a major move for food aid in the last year or so. Rather than effectively putting food into developing countries that's grown in Europe and North America, the challenge now is to provide money to increase food production in developing countries, and this is a major step forward. Clearly, how do you get the farmer to recognise the multifunctionality of agriculture? Well, you need to pay it, not only to produce food, but for ecological services. So the payment set at environmental services is a critical factor in the way we need to move forward. So we've got to recognise we pay the farmer not just for producing food, but for maintaining ecological services, which are absolutely essential for human well-being. Not just the provisioning services, but the maintenance services, the regulating services, and the cultural services, pollination services, control of water quality, purification of the atmosphere, limiting the climate change. Many, many services that currently don't provide money in the marketplace. We need to make the market work so the farmer is appropriately paid for maintaining or even enhancing these services. Water is a critical challenge. some of these areas, this is actually right, should be nice, great enough. Some areas effectively are withdrawing greater than 90% of their water for agriculture. Many areas 50 to 70%. In fact, average over developing countries, 70% of all fresh water is used in the agricultural sector. And it's largely misused. Why? There's no appropriate water pricing policies. And in some countries, there's no appropriate energy pricing. Now, there is a moral and ethical issue. Is it a human right to water? Should there be a charge for water? And the question is, how can we use water sustainably without wasting it, but making sure poor people have adequate water that they need for human health, for cooking, etc. So there's a major issue around water pricing policy, so that it's a real scarcity. A third of the people in the world today live in a water scarce or water stressed area. By 2025, two-thirds of the world's population will live in an area that's water stressed or water stressed, and that's without climate change. Climate change should always be viewed as an additional stress on already stressed systems. Let's not even bother with that detail. On food, on climate change, almost any warming will decrease agricultural productivity in the tropics and subtropics. We're already seeing it. In temperate regions such as that, North America and Europe, we're seeing a longer thermal growing season, so agricultural production will probably go up for probably a decade or so. But once we hit 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial, unless we have a technological fix, we're likely to see a decreased productivity even in the United States and within Europe, especially in the southern Mediterranean, that's projected to get much, much drier. Water will be a major problem around the world. More than 1 billion people rely on runoff of glaciers, snow melt from the mountains. 60,000 glaciers around the world are already melting. Adversely affects water for both agriculture and for human consumption, and coral reefs around the world are highly threatened. This simply shows you a projection for climate change for the 2020s, 2050s and 2080s. All the areas in orange and yellow, which is all of the developing countries, by 2020 have reduced agricultural productivity but no real loss of global productivity because of the enhancement in the temperate region. But by 2080 we would project a decrease in global productivity if, again, I say we don't have a technological revolution that will allow for either agroecology or better use of biotechnology, which I'll come to in a minute. The UK, just to put it in perspective, what we project would happen would be a warmer, wetter winter and a warmer, drier summer, and with the precipitation, more of it will fall in very heavy precipitation events, less light precipitation events, because there's in the same geographic area there could be both more floods and more droughts in the same year. Exactly the sort of conditions you don't need for ecological systems. So we clearly would get a longer thermal growing season for crops in the UK. We would have to see a change in geographic rain. There will be increased heat stress on livestock, increased pests and pathogens, increased storm damage, for example. So it will be a challenge. We're going to have to see what are the opportunities for bringing in crops that currently don't grow in the UK. So we're going to look at both the opportunities and the challenges, and that will be the same, of course, throughout the rest of the world. But in general, we believe it will be a threat to agriculture, clearly not an opportunity. And the part that I don't think we've understood well enough is the implications of a warmer, wetter, or warmer, drier climate on pests and pathogens, and how we'll deal with the pests and pathogens. Let's miss that one. So what are some of the things we need to do, both from a UK perspective and a global perspective? How do we address water deficit problems? Can we generate drought-tolerant crops? Can we have improved irrigation technology, so precision irrigation, not mass irrigation? How do we address the issue of soil fertility and salination of soil? How do we improve the nutritional quality of food? How do we increase the temperature tolerance of crops? How do we combat pests and diseases? How do we reduce external inputs, basically, reduce post-harvest loss? In Africa today, the average African farmer gets 1 tonne per hectare. His Asian counterpart is closer to 4 tonnes per hectare. But it's not only the productivity that's low in Africa, post-harvest loss often hits 40%. So the first challenge is how do we increase productivity, and we can do that with the technologies we already have today. We can do it either with a little bit more input, and I mean carefully managed input. We can use agroecology. We can effectively do it much more widely, but we also need to reduce post-harvest loss. So we can get effectively more food to the market in most parts of Africa by a factor of 3, 4, and 5 without any new technologies that we don't already have today, and we simply have to use those technologies better. So as I said, we already have many technologies to meet the challenge of hunger and poverty. However, we need to integrate local knowledge, indigenous knowledge, with contemporary knowledge from universities and government labs. The farmer in the field, whether he be in the UK or whether he be in Africa, knows a lot about his local environment. And too often we parachute in to Africa new knowledge from a university in the US or somewhere in Europe and expect the farmer to take up that crop. One, it may not be affordable. Two, it may not be socially acceptable. It may not even be consistent with the local environment. So we've got to understand that putting the farmer in the middle of decisions so that we understand the need of the farmer in a developing country, and we work together with the farmer to come up with an appropriate culturally, economically and environmentally sustainable answer. But there may be some challenges that we face, such as climate change, new diseases in animals, where we will need some advances in agricultural science and technology. There are many, many new diseases in plants like rust, emergence more striking, new animal diseases. So we've got to see what can we do with our current knowledge and also what do we need with new knowledge. The biotechnology. Too many people equate modern biotechnology simply with genetic modification. It's not that. It's tissue culture, it's many, many other things which are absolutely useful. The challenge we have in biotechnology are elements of modern biotechnology, and that is genetic modification. The questions there are, to what degree do we need genetic modification or not? So the first question is, what is the problem we're trying to solve? What do we already have in our toolkit, technologies, practices and policies to address those problems? If we need to think beyond the current technologies, we should ask ourselves the question, what are the risks and benefits of any technology, whether it's genetic modification or not? What are the risks to the environment? What are the risks to human health? What are the societal implications? And look at risk-benefit analysis on a case-by-case basis. Many people have viewed our document as anti-science, anti-GM. No, we have said that many technologies we can use. We need to integrate agriculture into biodiversity, integrate it into the landscape, use agroecological approaches, but we do not say there will never be a need under some circumstances for at least thinking through whether genetic modification does or does not have a role. Bioenergy, potentially we need bioenergy for three reasons. Energy security, improving rural livelihoods and decreasing greenhouse gases. Fundamental problem is that it's not obvious that they're always environmentally friendly or socially acceptable. Bioelectricity is often quite environmentally, economically and socially acceptable. So the biofuels, liquid fuels, is bioethanol and biodiesel. It can come today from things like sugar and maize for bioethanol, palm oil, soy oil and rapeseed for biodiesel. Rarely economic. Became more economic in some parts of the world when oil went over $100 a barrel. Even in Brazil, which had been a de-success case, it wasn't economic until it was at least $50 a barrel, and Brazil could produce sugar at less than $200 a ton. They spent 25 years getting traits of 500 different cultivars of sugar cane so it can grow in different microclimates. Rarely economic, normally heavily subsidized. There's a real question if you look at both the direct and the indirect emissions of greenhouse gases from bioenergy of whether we are actually decreasing greenhouse gas emissions by using biofuels or increasing. And so the Gallagher review the other month when it came out, commissioned by the UK government, actually said we do not know at a global level today whether the use of biofuels is increasing or decreasing greenhouse gas emissions. We also looked effectively to say what were the social implications, and we are quite concerned that there's no doubt in certain parts of the world the use of food costs, as I've already said, is part of the increase in food price. The World Bank came up with a suggestion that the use of maize in the US had actually increased. 70% of the reason for the increase in maize prices was due to the US using maize for bioenergy, bioethanol. That seems very high. It's way above most of the projections, but it's certainly a contributor. So if we're going to move to biofuels, which potentially can be win-win-win, economically, socially, and environmentally, we've got to analyse whether we can go to second and third generation biofuels and make sure that we really analyse what the environmental, economic, and social implications are. We've really got to face the challenge of the small farmer. It's quite conceivable in China there'll be an aggregation of farms and they'll go larger and larger and larger, especially with the government they have in place, and they'll go the way of the US. But in Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, most farms are going to stay smaller, hectare or so, potentially. Therefore, we've got to create opportunities for innovation and entrepreneurship which targets the small-scale farmer. We've shown that there's a huge rate of return of public research and extension. In many cases, 50%, in other words, the internal rate of return of investing in research or extension in sub-Saharan Africa, or in Asia, or in Latin America, can have a rate of return of up to 50%. I qualify it a little bit and say they haven't looked at either the positive or the negative externalities, and you have to take that into account when you look at an economic rate of return. That is to say, the positive things on improved health, but the negative things, which are sort of degradation of the environment, that should be costed in as well, which reduces down the rate of return. We've also got to look to see who invests and who benefits. But fundamentally, all the evidence suggests that investment in public research in agriculture has a high payoff. We've got to think through how to actually help the small farmer. I've already mentioned efforts such as payment for ecological services. We've also got to recognise, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, but other developing countries, women are a key part of the workforce, often 70%, and that's in yellow, which you can't see, and yet very few women are in extension services to take the knowledge that we had and translate it to being useful on the ground. So women, while they're major players in agriculture in developing countries, one, rarely have access to finance, two, rarely have property rights, and three, often can't communicate due to a gender gap between extension workers and themselves. So we've got to take the gender issue into account as we address the issue of development. Trade, absolutely a critical issue. The Doha round of negotiations would have been a step in the right direction. Many, many poor people around the world have gained from liberalisation of trade, but many people have not. We need to think through what is a truly pro-poor trade regime. So we need to look at the whole trade system, we have to look at escalating tariffs, and understand how can we have a trade regime that is fair and equitable, and as I said, Doha would have been a step in the right direction, but there are some special needs for developing countries and poor people in developing countries, which is why the last round of Doha did not succeed. But clearly when you have huge subsidies in the US or parts of Europe for production subsidies, not if they're for ecological services, that's a very good way to go, but if they're simply production subsidies, you get excess food, you dump it in a developing country, it actually inhibits the desire for agricultural productivity. There's been a major fund of shift in funding, I've just about finished. In an OECD country, the private sector invests more than the public sector. But in developing countries, it's still driven by public sector funding. The reason there's no private sector funding in developing countries other than in China, India and Brazil is they can't appropriate the value and there's very poor governance structures. But we've got to recognise we need public-private partnerships that also aim at the poor. You can't read this, but this actually shows graphically what I've already said, and that is there's very little private sector funding in developing countries, but there's actually a significant amount in developed. So what are some of the suggestions? We need to improve the public-private civil society involvement in AKST, agricultural knowledge, science and technology, that makes us all accountable for both social and environmental outcomes, as well as production outcomes. We need to develop macro-level policy changes, such as trade, and we need to link agricultural knowledge, science and technology with our development goals. We've got to shift away from only having a production focus. We do need to increase production. We do need to increase agricultural productivity. But we've got to do it in a way that is consistent with our environmental outcomes that we desire, our social outcomes, and we've clearly got to recognise that climate change is a major threat to the agricultural sector. But the agricultural sector today is a threat to climate change, and that's a really big challenge. We need to build and reform at the agricultural knowledge, science and technology skill base, not only in developing countries but in developed countries, especially in applied research. And you clearly have to find ways to stimulate innovation in your communities. So the last one is the conclusion. Climate change poses both opportunities and challenges to the agricultural sector. It's not simply production, it's multifunctionality. Innovation is critical and you have to involve all stakeholders in innovation. The farmer needs to be in the middle, especially the small-scale farmer, to participate in processes in developing countries. And science and technology is critical to realising a world that can get rid of both hunger and poverty. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So thank you very much indeed, Bob. And I'm sorry this is a late start. We're running a little bit late. My own reflections on that, someone who was brought up on a very small farm, 3 acres, down in West Cornwall, and my father somehow managed with 30 different varieties of fruit and vegetables. He's the same as having with myself and my seven brothers and sisters for many years, and never, I think, took any of that produce more than 10 miles, perhaps because of four, and which went off to the public garden on the train at Christmas time. So my father considers what's happened since then is progress. he's very proud of the progress that he's seen around the world. So I think we probably do need to reflect on what's happened in this country, as well as looking at those lessons which we can learn.